This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
Yeah, no, that is not true. I'm not sure if I can swear on your show.
You can.
I fucking love Fiasco.
That's great.
I will play it anytime with anyone.
No kidding.
My ardor for the game is not diminished. I think because it's really a showcase for the participants. And so I really enjoy people. I enjoy seeing creative genius in all its forms. And a group of people that are really engaged in that game are going to support each other and create something really fun together, no matter what.
Faithful listeners have heard Jason Morningstar brought up in several interviews with other designers. If you listen to my interview with Shannon Appelkind, he specifically noted Jason's huge impact on modern game design. Now, I expected to learn from interviewing him, but was delighted to discover that he's also a kind and generous person with copious and contagious enthusiasm. We talk about how he approaches many of his famous and possibly lesser-known games. We discover he isn't tired of Fiasco yet. Be sure to stick around towards the end when he teaches me what LARPing really is and dispels many of my misconceptions. At the end of April, his company is crowdfunding two new games, Deadhouse and The Isabel, on GameFound using their new Desperation system. The tag on the website calls these games two games of survival horror, often without the survival. So you know I'm all in. Desperation provides unique card-driven gameplay for gothic storytelling experiences steeped in actual history. Deadhouse and The Isabel are dark, lyrical games about people pushed far past their limits. If you like card-based role-playing games like For the Queen and The Quiet Year, but have a dark and unmerciful heart, you'll love Desperation. Scroll down and check out the link below. A quick thank you to a few of our newest patrons: Naomi Dempsey, B-Match, Masukomi, Fabian Peekert, and Peter Thomas. Because of you and the other floorheads on Patreon, I continue to provide gaming content on a weekly basis. All right, friends, sit back, relax, and enjoy my time with Jason.
Do you love to unplug and play games around the table? Greetings, friends and floorheads, to Tabletop Talk from Third Floor Wars. If you love tabletop gaming, you are in the right place. Listen as Craig delivers in-depth discussions and interviews with game designers, creators, insiders, and experts. Learn from the people making and playing the role-playing, miniature, and board games you love.
Howdy, friends. Craig here. Today we're talking to the author, designer, and founder of Bully Pulpit Games, Jason Morningstar. Now, many of you know him as the creator of the game Fiasco. He has also created for tons of other games and publishers, including Steve Jackson Games and Pelgrane Press. You've heard his name several times as I've talked to other designers, and he is a two-time Diana Jones Award winner. So, Jason, welcome to the Third Floor.
Thank you, Craig. It's good to be here.
So, you got to go through the standard question that everybody gets, which is, at one point you knew nothing about tabletop gaming and role-playing and throwing dice and pretending to be other people, and then one day you were exposed to it for the first time. Can you take me back there?
Yeah, I guess I would argue that that's not really my trajectory.
Oh, okay.
My dad was a gamer. So he was really into war games and miniatures war games when I was a kid. And at that time, that meant SPI games.
Yeah.
Everything back to like Tactics 2.
Nice.
Campaign for North Africa. Like the whole thing. He was really into it.
All the chits and everything.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Borodino, Panzerleader, wow. Those kinds of games. And so I grew up watching him and my uncle play these games. Which, you know, was both validating and really exciting for a young child to see that these were grown-ups who were very engaged with play in a way that was at that time still a little alien to me. But of course, you know, my dad was the coolest guy in the world, and I wanted to emulate that. And so gaming was always normalized in my household.
That's great.
When my uncle came over one day with a copy of White Box D&D and said, "Hey, I just picked this up at the hobby store, at the Alcove Hobby Shop on Woodward in Ferndale, Michigan. And I have no idea what to do with it. This doesn't make any sense to me." he put it down, and my brother and I picked it up, and we're like, we know what to do with this. We got it. We'll take it from
here. How
did
you know that?
Well, when he described it, he said, "Well, you know, it's this game where you play a single person rather than a unit, and the combat rules are a little iffy, and there's weird magic, and we were like, okay, yeah, we get it. Just give it to us. We'll make it work." And that we were off to the races. It felt very, very natural.
Really?
For us. Yeah.
So one of the things that I remember as a kid struggling, because we're similar age, right? So for those younger kids listening, there's no internet, there's no Twitch streams, right? So you know, we get our white box put in front of us, and you just kind of have to fudge through it and figure it out. How hard of a process do you remember? If that was just super easy, or did you guys just fake it till you make it, or did you never play it the way it was written?
Yeah, I mean, it's such a that particular product is so perplexing. It's really hermetic, and everyone's going to play it their own way, of course, just because there's not a lot of there
right.
in original D&D, which is part of what's beautiful about it. And that's definitely not a criticism. So my brother is 4 years older than me, so he really took the lead on sort of figuring out how it worked. And I was just rocking out as a wizard doing my thing. And he was my first DM, and it was a great time. And of course, we moved on to Advanced Dungeons & Dragons as soon as we possibly could. And then other games that were even more influential than D&D for us.
So when you look back on that, Jason, what do you think was kind of the first next big game for you? So outside of D&D, was there a game that you remember growing up that just like kind of knocked your socks off or occupied your headspace?
Yeah, for sure. So we played D&D until we got our hands on Traveler.
Oh,
and
wow.
GDW's original Traveler, Mark Miller's Traveler, just destroyed us. We were all in. And honestly, Traveler taught me a lot. Like, I learned a lot because I was highly motivated to you know, do the things I wanted to do in that game in a way that I just wasn't being challenged in real life. So this is a common story for young nerds, but I was not a good student. I was just not motivated. I wasn't interested. It just didn't work for me, the traditional educational model. And so my teachers were like, "Well, he's obviously really smart, but he's failing." And, you know, like, I remember there was a time when my mother was having one of these parent-teacher meetings, and she said, "Jason, I got to go talk to your teachers. Can you just show me some of the stuff that you're learning in these games?" And I'm like, "Absolutely. All about, you know, gravitational lensing and applied kinematics and Traveler. I'm learning what mortgages are, Mom. I'm playing the stock market in Traveler." Right?
And I financed my ship, Mom.
Exactly. Like, I got a 40-year mortgage to pay off. This is no joke. And that was her way of like demonstrating to these teachers who just weren't really committed to my success that I could do the work if properly motivated and engaged. And that was really great. But yeah, like that game taught me a lot, as did some others in other maybe worse ways. But the progression for me was D&D. Of whatever flavor, then Traveler. And then I started to get hooked into the local gaming scene, which is really exciting because there were people that were designing games in the Metro Detroit area where I grew up. And I, at a very young age, I was still like in middle school. I plugged into these people who were college kids basically at the time that were developing games like The Morro Project and Stalking the Night Fantastic, Bureau 13, which are really interesting, fun, cool games that really no middle school kid should be playing. but That was my first introduction really to like the scrappy end of game design, which was exciting too.
Well, I would imagine too, at an early age, it shows you that that's doable, right? That people make games, which, you know, sounds silly, but as I talk to more people, Jason, that's one of the things I hear is I hear like, oh, then I learned you could make your own games. And that's a huge revelation. You had that at a very young age.
Well, I did. Yeah, I really did. And I'm grateful for it.
Did you, I mean, what was it like for you as a kid working with unfinished games and playtesting these things as they were going? Was that like, just like, hey, it's just another game for me? Did it even register you what was happening?
Yeah. Like I was aware of the process. The people at, this was Richard Toholka and Tritac was the company that was doing all this stuff. And Timeline Incorporated was doing the Morrow Project. So it was the same sort of crew of nerds that were 10 years older than me probably at the time. And it was very clear that they were making something and that they were refining it over time and that the rules changed. And I got to see that process and participate in it in some way, but not in a critical way. Like I was just there to play always.
Right.
You know, I was there to have a good time and to have some crazy adventure and to usually shoot some things and, you know, do the things that a 12-year-old or 13-year-old wants to do playing a role-playing game. So
I'm taking my kid through the Jason Morningstar Museum, and we go to the first exhibit and it's D&D. We go to the second exhibit and we see, you know, you working with indie games before indie games existed. What's the next big exhibit I'm going to look at? So in your mind, growing up and developing, what do you think was the next biggie?
Happy to answer that. But before I do, I just want to point out that indie games have always existed. It's not like it's something that I mean, as soon as people got their hands on original D&D, they started hacking it. And so like, it's always been there.
Yeah,
it's always
great
been
point.
Part of the landscape. So for me, D&D, then Traveler, then these sort of regional homebrew kinds of games that turned into Bureau 13, which is reasonably well known, and the Morrow Project, reasonably well known early 80s games. Real excited about that stuff. And then I kind of got turned on to GURPS when GURPS became a thing. I was an early adopter of GURPS. And that's what led to my decline and ruin, because GURPS is totally modular by design, right? Like it doesn't presuppose a setting. It gives you this toolbox, right? And so suddenly I had this really cool set of tools that emerged from the Fantasy Trip, which you know, Melee and Wizard, which are, you know, beautiful tactical board games with this sort of fictional gloss that became In the Labyrinth, which is amazing. And we played the hell out of that, which became GURPS, right? You can see the DNA all through Steve Jackson's, I hope this isn't too inside baseball.
Like, no, it's not. Steve's been on the show, so no means.
Fantastic. Okay. So hugely influential. And to see that progression was also enormously informative as a proto designer too, right? Because you could see the DNA from the Fantasy Trip in GURPS, right?
Yeah.
You had to change it. But
go ahead. I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
Oh, I was going to say, so it's one thing for Jason now to look back at that, right? And see the through line between those games leading to GURPS. Did you have a sense of that as you were playing it at the time, or
No, no, absolutely no question. At that time I was thinking critically about it and could see the choices that he'd made, how he had changed it, the things that didn't quite work in the Fantasy Trip as a sort of role-playing game, that absolutely he hit all those marks in GURPS. And I was like, okay, you know, lesson learned.
So there's a lot of people listening, Jason, and I'm listening to you. You know, I played games, I hacked games, and, you know, my version of white D&D is nothing like the one you played. And I fell in love with GURPS like you did. Not for exactly the same reasons, but, you know, there's some overlap there, right? What I never did is create a game. Or desire to do more than create a game at my table. When did that bug first hit you, where you said, I want to do a little bit more?
That's a good question. And for me, I think it was a pretty natural evolution. So I started out, I talked about my gradual descent to ruin, right? So I started out with GURPS kind of as written, using rules to model reality, which I think GURPS is really trying hard to do. Which is an interesting choice. Looking back on it, I was very interested in realism for a long time, and now I'm not, but at the time I was. But over time, as my tastes and interests changed, that became less important. And what became more important was ease of play and the speed at which we could get into whatever the theme or concept that we were trying to explore was. And so I pared GURPS away, right? Like my version of GURPS became really close to bare metal, right? Which GURPS accommodates very well. Like you can take stuff out just as easily as you can bricolage stuff onto it. And so there was a point at which I wanted less than GURPS would provide. Like I wanted it to do less than the minimum amount it would allow me to do. And you know, casting about, that led me to Fudge, right? Which is even simpler and similarly modular. So we played Fudge for a while, and the same kinds of pressures built, where I started to hack Fudge to be simpler in different ways. And then it became a point where I was making my own games, right? And those games were meeting my needs and the needs of my friends around my table, but they became progressively further afield from what we had been doing previously. And at that point, I was into it. You know, I was excited about making games for my friends, and started participating in contests, participated in Game Chef. And one of my Game Chef games, some people that I really respected and admired who didn't know me and I didn't know them, coming out of Game Chef, they said very matter-of-factly, "We liked this game. We played it at Gen Con. It was very fun. When are you publishing it?" Right? And
yeah.
And the answer was, I guess as soon as I can. I don't know. So that's really sort of the evolution of my ascent into designhood, I guess. And I would, if it's okay, I just want to add that I think everybody who hacks a game, everybody who's writing adventures for a game, is a game designer. And I don't want to put that term or my own community of practice on a pedestal. I think that's a little toxic, and I don't want to come off as somebody who thinks it's a rarefied profession. I think we're all doing that all the time if we really are engaging with the hobby.
Yeah, I think that's a wonderful point, Jason, a wonderful point. And it's a point that I enjoy hearing people say on the show, because I'm a victim. I fall into that trap, right? Thinking that, you know, you have to be some sort of special chosen child in order to publish a game. But, you know, especially in this day and age, yeah, you know, the boundaries are gone, right? You
no,
know, the,
yeah, the, this is a golden age for that.
Yeah.
It's amazing to me how easy it is to share your work, which, you know, has been a barrier. There's been barriers to entry for a long time, and most of them are gone. That doesn't mean there aren't problems, and it doesn't mean that sharing your work means that it becomes a viable avenue toward recognition or success. But
sure. But the traditional model is gone in many ways, which I think is important. So guys, the Insider Insight series is my opportunity to sit down with designers, developers, artists, writers, and creators and learn how they approach their work. I try to understand their process, inspiration, and the methods for crafting their creations. We're going to take a quick break. When we get back from this break, I want to talk about Jason's kind of next step, where we see him starting to create material for other people's games, including GURPS, and then we'll move on from there. So we'll be right back. This is the part of many podcasts where someone comes on, interrupts the show, and explains that you should consider paying for the content that you're listening to right now for free. That pitch man explains by giving a dollar or more a month, you not only support the show, but you allow the show to grow and improve. Here on the third floor, we refuse to interrupt your episode of Tabletop Talk with such time-wasting pleas. We pledge never to run a spot asking you to go to patreon.com and give a dollar or more a month, because supporting content creators keeps the content coming, even if there is a link in the show's description. And there is. We don't ask you to click it and become a patron. We don't waste time rambling about the benefits like early access to episodes, getting episodes without ad breaks like this.
or even getting a chance to play in one of Craig's RPG sessions. Anyway, enjoy this episode, knowing Tabletop Talk, despite being supported by its patrons, won't engage in such blatant appeals for support.
So you find out people are playing this game that you put together for Game Chef, and they say, you know, wow, this is when you're putting it out. What was it next after that, Jason? Did you put the game out?
We did. Yeah, that was the first game I published. It was called the Shab El Hiri Roach.
You've got to tell people about this game because it's amazing. Yeah,
okay. So it was 2006. I was in graduate school, and that year the Game Chef ingredients were entomology, accuser, wine, and something else. So I was really in an academic mode at that point, and I started thinking entomology, so insects and bugs, accusers, some kind of paranoid situation, wine, well, of course, like faculty meetings and, you know, highfalutin academic life. And out of those things came this sort of this game that really sort of was reflecting my lived experience at that point, which is the Shab El Hiri Roach. And the premise of the game is that you're in a sort of tweedy New England college campus, and somebody has brought a telepathic, mind-controlling, ancient Sumerian insect that can climb into your sinus cavities and take over your brain. Which is
amazing.
Which is it's a good metaphor for graduate school, I think. And so if you're infested with this alien insect, it's asking you to do things that made sense in the context of being an ancient Sumerian god king, but that don't make sense in the context of a 20th century college campus. So half of the game is dealing with that stuff, which is sort of over the top, crazy, very silly. And the other half is just dealing with regular academia, like political infighting on campus. And they have equal weight and equal importance within the narrative. And so it's like a vaguely competitive game. It's very silly. It's super dark. It was very well received. People liked it. It's still available, but it's that was my first game. And it came once the idea to publish it came, we started the company. My friend Steve Seghetti and I started the company, Bully Pulpit Games, and we were off to the races at that point.
That's amazing. Now, was that that's a GM-less game, correct?
Yeah, it is. That's even so. At that point, I was really interested in how you apportion authority around the table, and was influenced by games that were starting to do that in really interesting ways. Games like Polaris that were doing it. And so for me, it was very natural. I was like, well, that's what I'm interested in. That's the space I like to play in. So that's a good place to set the sort of mechanical scaffolding for this game.
So Jason, as I've been talking to designers and we talk about GM-less games, and I've had some designers on that have produced GM-less games, they seem to drive back to you, right? But it sounds to me like you drive back much farther than you, that you weren't the first person to hate a GM and get rid of the GM. So I'm not familiar with Polaris. So how did Polaris, when you look at that as an influence on that concept, what did Polaris do that made you realize that maybe we could spread that around?
Sure. Well, first of all, I love GMs. I want everybody to be a GM. I think five heads around the table are going to come up with better things than one. So it's the opposite. I do not hate GMs.
I'm kidding. I know.
And there are plenty of places where that's the perfect arrangement. So anyway, that's often levied as an accusation at me, and I need to just disabuse you of the notion.
I mean, I wasn't the first one to make that joke, Jason. Is that what you're saying?
No, you were definitely not the first one. And Polaris is a great game that also came out of Game Chef and that doesn't have a GM, but has a very formalized structure where you're interacting with a person across from you at a table with four players. And everybody's got sort of ritualized roles within the fiction that they're responsible for. So it, in my mind, Polaris was a game that took the functions of a GM and distributed them asymmetrically around the table to create a composite single GM, basically. And then, so you get to be a player, and the other three players get to be a composite GM whose responsibilities rotate. But it's pretty fixed and pretty rigid. And I was always of the opinion that symmetry might be a better way to do it.
So gotcha. So asymmetrical, spread it out even.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting.
Having everyone have the equal amount of authority and
right.
credibility
right.
at any time.
So when do you start producing for other people? So when do you put out, what was it, Historical Folks for GURPS? And then
I contributed to that, yeah.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Trail of Cthulhu, you put some work out for. So how does that come together?
I have a network of friends and different people in the business, and I'm excited about what they're doing, or I'm excited about a project that I have that doesn't fit within the bounds of my company, and just either offer or volunteer or suggest, depending on the circumstances. So like with Pelgrane, they just had a standing offer because I'm friends with Simon and all those people. And they said, if you want to do something for us for Trail of Cthulhu, we know you like that stuff, and it's clearly not something your company is going to do, then, we're happy to see what you got. I played a lot of Call of Cthulhu. I like that sort of, cyclopean mind destroying horror genre stuff, and really enjoy putting my own spin on it because I love history and finding really cool historical touchstones for things is very satisfying. So like that just kind of worked out. In other cases, it was I was approached by people to do work for them. I guess based on, what I had already done. So, yeah, I was prior to this, I looked back on sort of the list of people I've worked with, and it's a lot. I was surprised. I'd forgotten how many different companies I've worked with.
Is there, as you look at that list right now, Jason, is there ones that stand out that you think had a real impact on your process? Not necessarily as a mentor by any stretch of imagination, but when you look at that list of, partnerships that you did, and you go, this changed me.
Oh yeah, that's a great question. That is hard to say. I think that probably the things that were most productive for me in terms of my own development as a game designer are things that I did in collaboration. So like I worked with Rachel E.S. Walton on Fall of Magic for Heart of the Unicorn. We developed the underworld for Fall of Magic, which is really fun. And working with Rachel was just a pleasure. I'm super interesting. Working with Alex Roberts, Randy Lubin, my good friend Lizzie Stark, who I'm sort of in a design partnership with, Jessica Crean. These are all people that I've done stuff with, and working in really close collaboration with another person is, I think, the most informative and most productive way to grow as a designer.
So when you're in those partnerships, Jason, do you find yourself playing a role? Is it some of that apportioned to Jason and then some of it apportioned not, or does that rotate, or is it spread evenly? When you're collaborating like that, what role do you play?
Yeah. I think it varies with the partner, and it's important in that sort of a collaboration that both partners either have a clear understanding that it's sort of 50-50 and that we're each going to be doing the same amount and the same kind of work, or that you recognize each other's strengths. And this is a much better model. Leaning on those strengths. So in my partnership with Lizzie Stark, for example, I'm the layout guy. I'm going to lay out all their products. I'm going to do the visual design because that's just something I'm good at. And that's not an area that Lizzie cares to get involved in. And she has other things that she brings to the table that are not that. And we just know that as a team. So often, like in our most recent collaboration, there was a point where we said, okay, I'll see you in a couple of weeks. I'm going to lay this out. You do the research related to the music that we need to incorporate into this product. And then that's where she went and spent her energy while I did the visual design. and then we regrouped.
So something that that I've heard is that you also enjoy LARPing and creating for LARPs. Is that correct?
Yeah.
Okay. Where did that come from? Because that's a slightly different animal.
It is. It's a very different animal. And designing for LARP is very different and really challenging in a whole different way. I just love it. And I think it's part of it is that, I think over my career, I see things getting simpler and simpler mechanically.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe a little more elegant, a little more subtle. And with LARP, you can't have any extraneous complication. Everything has to be very clear, very elegant in play, very bomb-proof, as much as you can make it. And I really appreciate that. And then the sort of the kinesthetics of LARP are just a pleasure to me. I come from a background of performance, so I love acting and chewing the scenery and waving my hands around and designing for that. I'll go nuts about LARP if you want me to.
Let's do it.
Okay. So it's exciting to me because I think it gets to the core of why we played these kind of games quicker. That the peak experiences that you have in tabletop play will come, and they come with a significant investment usually. You don't usually sit down for a couple of hours and walk away saying, that was profound. I was moved by that. And I've, experienced something new. Whereas with LARP, that can happen in 2 hours all the time. And I love that. And I want to see that more. And I try to bring that back into tabletop design as much as I can, with varying amounts of success, since it really is a different medium.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think it's true. And I've seen it. And also LARP, it allows a much easier sense of empathy, I think. Like for me, you can really embody a character in a more holistic way in LARP, whereas tabletop gives you boundaries. And those boundaries are both convenient and sometimes necessary. And there's nothing unhealthy about them, but it's very different. When I say your father says he's disappointed in you, Craig, that's very different from I'm your dad and I'm disappointed in you. There's less alibi. There's less aesthetic distance between those two. And it can be much more intense. If your audience is all tabletop players, they should be trying LARP because it's absolutely amazing.
Well, I'm headed in that direction because I was thinking the same thing. So that's a hobby. That's part of the hobby I've never participated in. It's a little funny to me because, I think about being a role player and granted this has changed a lot recently, but there was always this perception of what role playing was and then the reality of what role playing is. Right. And I still feel in a lot of ways, we're still in the perception phase with LARPing, though that's changed as well. So for someone listening who all they know is, the guy in the paper hat throwing sand, saying, fireball,
yeah, yeah.
What's the reality of LARPing that people have yet to really experience if they haven't?
Yeah, no, thank you for asking, Craig. So first of all, the fireball, paper hat guy, that's fun as hell. And there is nothing wrong with that.
Right.
You almost certainly have a local group that is doing that. And, I'm all in. That is very fun. You can absolutely play silly fantasy games in the woods on the weekend, and it's a great time. It's not my focus as a designer or a player, but it's definitely a good way to engage with and make really good friends. What I'm interested in is short experiences that take maybe a couple hours to play, maybe 4 to 8 players, so games that you could play in an afternoon or an evening. That maybe deal with more serious themes, or things that are like that have a broader tonal spectrum that aren't necessarily fantasy games. I've got a surreal game that takes place on the sky deck of the world's tallest building, where you're trapped there and time passes and things get really weird, like a Louis Buñuel movie.
Nice.
I've got a game that's about a small town election in America. So it's about the fifth seat on the board of aldermen in just a rural community, which of course is going to be, you know, like super intense. You know,
right.
The people who want that seat really want it, even though only 18 people are going to vote. That game is paced around the local public radio station's interviews. So if you play
cool.
it with a soundtrack where the local DJ is asking you questions, that's part of the soundtrack, and the candidates get to answer, and then it's a whole thing. So like a wide range, there's a huge stylistic range and tonal and thematic range for games that can be super fun. And that's just like one slice of the pie, right? So we talked about Silly Paper Hat People. We talked about my, you know, 2 hours, Let's Make Each Other Cry games. or you know, Fall Down Laughing games. But there's also people who are super into vampire LARPs, and that's a very well-established genre that ties in with the tabletop game Vampire the Masquerade. There are people who are doing blockbuster LARPs, which is not right now, of course, but in the before times, where you'd get together for a weekend and have super high production value, really intense, amazingly costumed weekend events, which are astonishing and great. And then there's, you know, there are other styles as well all over the world. If you have preconceptions about it that are based on depictions in the media, they're probably wrong.
So this might be a dumb question, but I'm going to ask it anyway, Jason. Where does the line get blurry when we start to define this out? So if I say this game is a tabletop game and this game is a LARP, where's the border?
And you are asking such good questions. That is super great. And the answer, I think, is very subjective, super subjective. So there's a really well-regarded event in Denmark called Festival. And at Festival, they have it's a game convention. They invite submissions, and then if your game is accepted at Festival, they arrange game masters and facilitators to run your game 5 or 10 times at the event. And then there's a panel of judges, all of whom will have played. And then there's also feedback from the people who've played. So like if it's a 10-person game, 100 people have played your game, and
that's
all giving feedback on it. And at Festival, a scenario at Festival is, we would call it a LARP, but they call it a tabletop, right? It is exactly in that gray area. They're typically very highly structured, but you might get up and move around. You're going to, you know, interact in a more physical kinesthetic way, maybe. But there's going to be some really set things that we would recognize from tabletop role playing as well. And so like, it's really fun to talk to Europeans for whom the definition is,
right.
The blur is a little in a different place.
Yeah.
And I play with that too in my tabletop games. So the idea of using time as an element is something that you see in LARP a lot. And in my game, The Skeletons, I ask you to just sit there and think in the darkness for a minute or 30 seconds or a couple of minutes, which is a very LARPy kind of thing to ask you to do. And I totally learned that from LARP. I've got another game called Carolina Death Crawl. And in Carolina Death Crawl,
I love the names of your games.
Oh, thanks. In that game, when you're eliminated, it's a funnel. It's an elimination game. Only one character will survive.
Okay.
And so as soon as your character perishes in some horrible way, you become a swamp ghost. And you no longer have a seat at the table. So it's a tabletop game until your character dies, and then you have to get up and just whisper horrible things in people's ears. That's your job for the rest of the game, is to be the embodiment of their fears and their anxieties. And it works really great.
Do you think is the physicality part of that transition from one to the other, do you think, Jason?
Yeah, for sure. I think so. I think that once you get up and start moving, then you're definitely at least approaching live action play. Usually that's a sign. There are plenty of LARPs that are essentially committee games where you're sitting around a table deciding an important thing. That's actually a very standard format. And that's pretty much a tabletop game. You know, there are rules. You're sitting around a table. You're playing a character. So yeah, there are definitely interesting blurry lines. And I would say that if you're feeling like, I don't know if I want to really try that, there are games that are very close to tabletop, but still let you experience the fun things about LARP. I wrote a game called The Climb specifically for that. It's a gateway game that's designed to get you into a sort of a LARP headspace without really going too deep.
Gotcha. So The Climb, is there any non-Jason gateway games we can recommend people?
Oh, yeah, yeah. The place to look, my suggestion is there's a yearly competition called the Golden Cobra Competition, which is specifically designed to produce short-form LARPs. And the games that win the Golden Cobras often meet those criteria. They're often very small, very beautiful games that that do not have a very demanding premise, but that will expose you to LARP in a really fun way, and that are really cool and interesting to play.
You're a good salesman, Jason. I like it. That's cool.
I want you to get out and try some of these games. You're going to love it.
You got me. I got to be honest with you, man. I've never had an interest in it, but you know, a lot of that is not full. It's like it's so many things, right? You just don't understand it. Now mm-hmm. that I have a much clearer understanding of what falls under that umbrella, it makes it far more approachable. That's for sure. And twice a year, I have a group of guys who go down to Jordan Lake, where you know where that is.
I do.
And we go
exactly
camping.
Where you go. Yeah.
Yeah. It's camping for gamers. I do it twice a year. And it's about 20, the pool of people is about 20 guys. And, you know, get anywhere from 8 to 15 of them show up for each individual trip. And all we do is play games. Like we play board games and card games during the day. And then at night we, you know, run RPGs. That seems like a potential easy scenario to try to flex something like that out.
100%. So yeah. Get in touch beforehand and I will curate the best perfect games for your group.
Oh, good Lord, Jason, you're going to spoil me.
I know. I will do it.
All right. That's a done deal. We're doing it in October. So awesome. Between now and in October, I'm going to bug you again.
Please do. No, I love that stuff.
That's super exciting. Guys, let's take another quick break. When you're back from this break, I want to talk about two games specifically. I want to talk about Gray Ranks and Night Witches. Really Gray Ranks, because as I started to explore that game, it got more and more fascinating to me, especially the theme. I think everybody's going to enjoy this conversation. We'll be right back.
If you're an athlete, you know the greatest motivator of all is the fear of letting your teammates down. After all, a team is only as good as its weakest link. So you owe it to those wearing the same jersey as you to be your best every time you step on the field. That's why there's no vape in team. When you vape, you can expose your lungs to toxic chemicals that can damage your lungs. If you're a step behind, the team's a step behind. Brought to you by The Real Cost and the FDA.
You like science fiction, right? You love playing games, maybe even role-playing games. But what if you can't get your friends together for a game night? If you love games like Mothership or Orbital Blues, check out Dead Belt, a card-based space western solo strategy RPG about skillful and desperate scavengers picking over the remains of junked starships in hopes of a juicy payday. In it, you deal with lurking dangers, push your luck, and walk away with enough cred to keep on flying. Of course, you might get eaten by lurking aliens, or run afoul of rival scavengers, or face the murderous ghosts of long-dead spacers. No one said life in the Dead Belt was going to be easy. For more information on this and all of Sean and Abby Drake's games, swing over to acoupleofdrakes.com. The link's in the show notes.
So, as I mentioned at the very beginning of the intro, obviously, you know, I knew who Jason was, and have loved Fiasco for a long time. I really enjoy Fiasco. But, you know, as soon as I, you know, keep hearing the same names as I'm interviewing other designers, and, you know, Jason Morningstar this, and I've read this from Jason Morningstar, I'm like, all right, I got to get Jason on the show. That then allows me, Jason, to dive in even deeper into stuff that you have done that I wasn't aware of, right? And two of the games that really piqued my interest that I wanted to talk about are Grey Ranks and Night Witches. What do you want to talk about first, or what should we talk about first?
Well, let's talk about Grey Ranks first, and we'll okay. talk about them in sort of order of development.
Perfect. So, first of all, can you tell everybody the premise of Grey Ranks? Because I think this one, I had to read it a couple times.
Yeah. So in Grey Ranks, you play Polish teenagers during the Warsaw Uprising. So it's 1944, and the citizens of Poland are going to generally rise up against the Nazi occupation. And if you know history, you know that this was a tragic event that did not end well. And it was a situation where many people had to make a lot of hard choices about their own survival and the survival of Poland as a nation. So it's a super, super intense, super sad story in general. And then when you combine that with the fact that there were essentially child soldiers that were fighting, it becomes even more intense. And that's the premise of the game.
So that sounds like fun. But to go back on that, Jason, like where are the beginnings of that? Like where did it start?
So a couple of things. So first of all, when you say that sounds like fun, I agree. There are different kinds of fun, right? There's type one fun, which is we're all having a good time and our sides hurt from laughing. And there's type two fun, which is that was awesome and I never want to do it again.
Interesting.
And Grey Ranks is more type two fun, but there's a lot of type one fun in it as well.
Okay.
We can sort of talk about that, but it is, it's a sad and story about a tragedy, like awful things happen. And within the game, the sort of arc of your character is going to be just epic in the most literal sense. They will change over the course of play in ways that you can't imagine. So, you know, either that grabs you or it doesn't. You really have to, as a group, have a conversation about that and just commit. And if you can commit to taking it seriously and trying it, then you'll have a really rewarding experience. And if anybody's not feeling it, then absolutely it's not the game for you. And that's fine. That's totally fine. But it's not as grim and intense as it as the pitch might make it. And you have a lot of narrative control. You have a lot of agency within the game. Your character, in fact, cannot die in Grey Ranks without your consent.
So, interesting.
You know, it's just there are some guardrails there to keep it from getting too intense.
And I assume that had to be the case because I obviously like safety tools of some sort was the first thing I thought of when I read that.
Yeah. It's super interesting because, you know, it's an early game and there are tools that are built into the game, but they're not safety tools. There's no X card in Grey Ranks because it didn't exist at the time.
Yeah.
If I were to write it today, it would be written very differently. And many things that are sort of, implicit in the design would be explicit.
Right. Sure. Right. So if I break into your house tonight and I find the notebook where the beginnings of this games were, what would I see jotted down? So where were the origins?
Yeah, this is such a dumb story. I'm always embarrassed when I tell this, but I knew the story of the Rising. It's part of my collective knowledge of history. I knew about it in the broadest sense. And there was a local game convention called MACE. And that one year, I think 2008, at MACE, they had a game design competition, a game chef competition. And the ingredients that they wanted you to make a game about were Ruined City and Romance. And the very first draft of Grey Ranks came out of me hearing Ruined City, Romance, and having it immediately flash to Warsaw and the Warsaw Uprising. I did a little bit of research and then found out about these teenagers that were fighting and it sort of, it all kind of came together. I won the competition. I got a medal. It's pretty great.
So in the arc of that design then, Jason, so there's the origins of it there. I'm always fascinated to know when it stops going uphill, when things start clicking, when the game started to come together, or when you feel like it matured in your mind. Do you remember, like, was there something that you did or a change you made where it all kind of came together?
Yeah, that's a good question. And this was it's a pretty complicated game in some ways.
Okay.
It's not complicated procedurally, but it's there's a lot of moving pieces. You're sort of navigating the mental space of your character as they go through this traumatic event. And it's played across 9 scenes, basically. And each scene is a specific time and date within the Warsaw Uprising. And your character is represented on a little grid that moves around. And the corners of that grid are dark places. So like one of the corners of the grid is martyrdom, where you're going to be for sort of propelled towards self-sacrifice. And another one is kind of the opposite of that. It's self-destruction. So making that work was extremely difficult, and making that playable and representative in the way that I wanted it to be took a lot of work. And there was a lot of back and forth discussion about it with my peers. And my friend Bill White is the guy who sort of cracked the case on Gray Ranks. He showed me how to make the grid work, which is great.
Oh, that's cool.
At that point I knew the game was functional, and it was more a question of assembling the materials that it needed.
Well, a game like that wins a prestigious award and obviously has an impact. Was there anything that surprised you when it got out in the wild? I'm always fascinated to hear, you know, you develop a game, you have your circle that you develop it with, but then it's out. It's not around you anymore. You don't get to show anybody how to play Gray Ranks.
Right.
Was there anything that came back from that fascinated you?
Yeah, absolutely. So you're right. As a game designer, once you release it, it's out in the wild and you don't get to come in the box and explain how things work. So, and that's a really important thing to remember, because you want people to be able to engage with it in the way that you want them to. And a game like Fiasco, for example, the game still kind of trundles along, even if you miss some of the rules. The game will still work. But Gray Ranks was not going to be that kind of game. So I had to make sure that it was very clear what you were supposed to do and when. And I spent a lot of time making sure that, and I think it was successful. The thing that surprised me, because I hadn't written a game that was sort of making emotional demands on the players, that wasn't super intense. At this point, I had made funny games up until this point, pretty much dark comedy, was that people would want to change that. They would want to sort of defuse the emotional intensity that's built into the concept. And the way that you do that is by hacking it to play Star Wars.
Okay.
Or hacking it to play Terminator, or whatever the overlying themes of the game are. So the themes are dystopia, surreal destruction. I don't even know. But if you can map that onto a science fiction property that is completely safe, and then you can engage with it in a way that doesn't require any emotional engagement at all. And that's something that I saw happen and continues to happen. And there's nothing I can do about it, but it always makes me a little sad, because you're avoiding one of the things that I really wanted you to experience, which is empathy and respect for the people who had to go through that, for whom it is ground truth. And it's within living memory. Those people are still around. That was 77 years ago, 77 years ago yesterday, in fact.
Unbelievable.
So, you know, it's it means a lot to me, and I was initially very dismayed when people chose to do that. I've kind of given up.
You don't have much choice, I would imagine. Beat your head up against the wall. So let's talk about Night Witches.
Okay. Do you want me to give you the pitch for Night Witches?
I would love it if you don't mind.
All right. So again, this is another World War II game. In Night Witches, you play members of the 588th Night Bomber Regiment, which is a unit in the Soviet Red Army. You're fighting in a war of existence against the Nazis on the Eastern Front. The game takes place over the course of the entire war. You start in 1941 and you end with the liberation of Berlin, if you're lucky. And the thing that's interesting about this game is that the 588th was composed entirely of women. All the officers, all the pilots, navigators, mechanics, everybody in the 588th was a woman. And so the game takes place at the intersection of total war and endemic sexism, because the Red Army didn't want them there, didn't want them flying, and did everything they could to derail their missions. So they were flying with the oldest, most outdated equipment, with the worst supplies, and were given the most dangerous jobs. That's the pitch.
Yeah.
That's what you're doing.
Is the World War II thing a coincidence, Jason, between the two, or is this something that is it a setting that you're finding fits for what you're trying to accomplish?
I think it's a little of both. I didn't intend to write a bunch of World War II games, but it's a very easy place to find counter narratives, right? So there are sort of established truths about what the Second World War was like that are not at all true. And I think it's interesting to explore those and to provide an opportunity for people to look at that material in a new way.
So Night Witches, did you know the 588 and then the game came, or did the game start and you found the 588?
Yeah, no, I read about them and immediately went home super excited to write a game. And in fact, I did. I wrote a game right away, and I knew, like, oh, this is cool. They were called the Night Witches. That's the best title ever.
Great name.
This is an amazing story. And I wrote a game and it was terrible. It just was no good. We played it and it was unsatisfying and stupid and broken. And I put it in a drawer for 5 years. I didn't look at it again because I knew that I just didn't have the tools that I needed to make it. I didn't look at it again until I played Vincent Baker's game Apocalypse World. And the minute I played Apocalypse World, a light went off and I opened the drawer again, because that was the technology that I was missing.
So when you say it, there's a beginning and an end, right? And if you make it all the way to the end, you get to the liberation of Berlin. And if this is oversimplification, just tell me, Craig, it's a dumb question. What are the decisions that I'm making as a player or as a group as I go from 41 to the liberation? Can I get a feel for that?
Yeah. So the game, you play it on duty stations, and each duty station is sort of a pinpoint in the map in the actual progression of this regiment. So in late 1942, you're fighting out of an airbase at Parisip over the Black Sea, right, for the Battle of the Crimea, basically. And within that, there are a series of missions that you have to accomplish before time telescopes forward. And each of those missions has its own parameters, and they're complicated and dangerous in different ways. So what happens, a duty station is owned by a particular player whose character recedes into the background. So if I'm facilitating Parisip, Duty Station 3, I think it is, I'm in charge of making all those missions happen every night. That's what happens to the night. And then during the day, I'm responsible for making your lives interesting. And the Apocalypse World engine does a really good job of systematizing the job of the game master, letting you know sort of the things that you are allowed to do and the things that you should do, how you ask and answer questions. And then it's all adapted, of course, for Night Witches, so that it's pretty clear what's happening. And the fiction sort of builds on itself because it's set up to be fundamentally impossible for you to succeed. Hmm. So in order to succeed at night, you need to be very effective during the day at securing the supplies you need and avoiding various kinds of political trouble that you might get into. And also just like keeping your heads down when there are heads to be lopped off. And all of that stuff takes energy and resources that you desperately need during the night. So your characters are constantly exhausted. They're never working at full capacity, or they're fresh as daisies, but they don't have the repairs that they need. So like, there's always a balance, and that's like where the role playing comes in, because you have to make these choices, and they're constantly getting more and more difficult. And it escalates over the course of the war as you develop bonds with these women. So it's a brutal game. Characters die all the time. And in some cases, you're making decisions about who that's going to be. So what happens, and this is the thing I really love about the game, because it echoes anyone's experience in war. And I don't have any experience in war, but you hear this from veterans all the time, particularly in extended conflicts like the Second World War or Vietnam, that the longer the conflict goes on, the less excited you are about being the last one to die.
Ugh.
Right? So when you get to the last couple of duty stations, it becomes a game of real delicate balance, walking on eggshells, trying to avoid being that last one to fall. And that becomes a whole different experience.
Yeah.
There's no more bravado. There is no more love for the new girl in the unit, because she is the one who's going to cause a problem. She's the one who's going to get you killed. And it's fascinating to see, because it just echoes those sort of military narratives from time immemorial.
Oh, wow. That's crazy. And so it sounds to me, if I'm understanding this correct, Jason, so the job of the I forget Vincent's term for it. It wasn't GM. It was something else.
MC.
The MC. Thank you. It sounds like the job of the MC rotates by station, and mm-hmm. and each, again, we're seeing that spreading of that responsibility going around the table. Is that right?
Yeah, that's true. That's true.
Oh, very cool. Very cool.
And the thing is, each of these games does it in a way that's in service of the game. So when I give talks about game design, I always say, listen to what the game wants. The game will tell you what it needs about how you apportion authority, how you divide credibility at the table. And it may be that there needs to be a traditional game master and players, but maybe not. And the game will tell you that. So in each of these cases, you can see I arrived at a different conclusion based on what the game needed.
Can you think of a time where a game just shouted that in your ear? I'd be curious to know, and it could be recent or not, where you were taking the game one direction and the game is like, no, this is wrong. And it took you onto the right path.
That's a great question. And I'm thinking about it. It's hard to say.
Because I've heard that said before, right, Jason, that you have to listen to the game and let the game take it. But I'd be very, I don't know what that feels like, right?
Yeah. Oh, Durance is a great example of that. Durance is awesome. Durance is another game that I wrote that's about, it's about the carceral state. It's about being imprisoned. It's about penal colonies. And the original version of Durance made the forces of imprisonment, the authority, sort of faceless, right? They were non-player characters. I think at that point it was still a GM-less game, but it was GM-less within the context of this is a story about prisoners. It's not a story about guards. And the epiphany I had in Durance is that they're all prisoners.
Interesting.
And that they're prisoners in different ways, but none of them are going home tomorrow. And at that point, it became really clear that what you needed as a player was a mirror to your own character's experience, which means that you got to play someone in authority and also a convict. And once that sort of happened, the game wrote itself.
It just all made sense after that.
It really
That's
did.
That's fascinating,
yeah.
Man. That is absolutely fascinating. So, guys, we're going to take another break. When we get back from this break, we're going to talk about a little game called Fiasco, which is probably where you most likely know Jason from. We'll be right back.
This is Sean. You may have heard of me from such movies as Brett and Sean Go to Illinois, Two Motorcycles, One Stick of Dynamite, and Gaming and BS. What kind of RPG podcast is that? After my NFTs were stolen, I decided to become a patron of Third Floor Wars. The content is great, and it costs me less than a good shot of liquor. So consider becoming a patron. It may just land you your next big role. Head over to patreon.com/thirdfloorwars. Tell Craig Sean sent you.
So we've covered a lot, Jason, and, you know, we've jumped around from games to games. Where does Fiasco fit in this timeline of ours?
Yeah, it's sort of after Grey Ranks, before Night Witches.
Okay. And the beginnings of that, because, I'll let you tell it. So where did the essence of it come from? Again, if I break into your house, find the notebook.
Yeah, you won't find that notebook. So Fiasco emerged from a pretty rigid process that I put on myself. I said, I've identified a problem, and that problem is that I'm often at conventions or gatherings with friends when I have 2 or 3 hours of dead time. I want a game that I can throw down on the table that we can play in 2 or 3 hours, tell a complete story, have a good time with anybody, that's perfectly accessible, and that creates a very satisfying narrative arc that wraps itself up. That's where I started. And as I developed Fiasco, any idea that I had that didn't meet that, I threw out. So rather than bending the game to what it wanted to be, I did the opposite, which was, in this case, very effective. It worked great. So like I had a version that had 3 acts instead of 2 acts, which is great because that mirrors film, right? Films typically have 3 acts. Took too long to play. The third act was boring. It got thrown out. There is no, the third act is now the aftermath in Fiasco.
Oh, okay. All right. Now, the version I have and the version I have played is the box set that is completely card driven. But it's my understanding that that's not the only version that's existed, that there was a book version first. What's different from that, from what I know Fiasco to be versus if someone has just the book version?
Sure. Well, you're playing the same game, but the boxed version of the game is there's 10 years of lessons learned in that box. So the original version of Fiasco really came out of the sort of small press tradition of the Forge and indie games at the time, which really was, there was sort of a doctrinaire answer to how you make a game, which is you put it in a perfect bound 6x9 book. And then you use index cards and Sharpies and dice, but like the game itself is a little book. And that's what we did with Fiasco originally. And that version is still in print because people like it and it continues to sell. Some people prefer it to the boxed version, and that's fine. It's functional and in some ways offers a little more depth in play. And there's a ton of play sets available for it. So it's not a bad bet.
Right.
But when we decided that we wanted to revise it, we really took stock on what we had learned playing it. I know that I've played it more than anyone else on the planet.
That's probably a good bet.
And I've learned a lot. And all of those things that I learned have gone into the version that you have, Craig, which is in a box. It uses cards instead of dice as randomizers. Things are a little bit more streamlined, plays a little faster. Provides what I think is a more cogent experience. And I can give you specific examples of things that are tuned up, but that's basically it.
Well, I would love to hear that, though. What's one example like you consider that to be, it might seem small, but it's actually a big difference?
Sure. Oh, there are so many. One thing is that when, this is my favorite, since we're using playing cards to generate situations. What that means is that we have all the affordances of cards instead of lists of things that we're writing down on index cards. So with playing cards, if I like the Poppleton Mall playset, but I want to play with my kids and I don't want any of the Satanism stuff in there, I can tune it. I can edit that out.
Right.
If I love Poppleton Mall and I also love business casual, I can mix those decks together and then we have a business office in the back of the mall, and those things work. They interoperate seamlessly.
Yeah.
And that opens up all these new, iterations and ways to explore and play that I just I'm really excited about and that I particularly enjoy. Mm-hmm. So that's a really easy example.
So when I had Steve Jackson on, God bless the guy, we had a segment in about GURPS, and he was, it's true Steve Jackson way, he was very honest with me. He said, Craig, I don't really want to talk about GURPS. And it wasn't that blunt, but it was close. And you know what? It made me think and pause for a second, because I was like, you know, I can imagine that being the case. Where do you still get excited about Fiasco? Do you still love Fiasco? Or do you, like, you know, are there other things that are your passion now? And Fiasco is awesome. We're not, you know, downplaying that, but I'm trying to figure out where it fits for you.
Yeah, no, that is not true. I'm not sure if I can swear on your show.
You can.
I fucking love Fiasco.
That's great.
I will play it anytime with anyone.
No kidding.
My ardor for the game has not diminished. I think because it's really a showcase for the participants. And so I really enjoy people. I enjoy seeing creative genius in all its forms. And a group of people that are really engaged in that game are going to support each other and create something really fun together, no matter what. You have to work really hard to have a bad time playing Fiasco. I've seen it. I know it can be done.
It's possible.
It is. I had another game designer actually who said, your game is broken and I'm going to prove it to you. And I was like, cool, sounds good. And we played a game of Fiasco where he very deliberately chose to have successful outcomes for his character constantly. Which, you know, great. You have a boring game of Fiasco, buddy. We're going to route around you to find the fun, and your character will be completely successful and have a happy ever after. And you have had a very boring 2 hours while we
congratulations
tore the room down all around you. And so, like, you know, that's possible. But most of the time, people are there for the right reason, and it's really fun. So, yes. There are other games of mine that I think I would not really want to revisit. I don't think I want to play the existing version of the Shabalhiri Roach anymore. And the reason for that is not because it's not a fun game, because it is, but it's kind of badly written. It takes too long to play. To play the game as written would take about 6 hours. And there's about 2 hours of fun in that game. So that's not happening. And also it is I found that it is a vehicle for punching down, which I don't like.
Interesting. How so?
It sets up a situation where you have alibi to be as shitty as you want. So your character is controlled by an evil insect that doesn't understand how things work. So maybe that's an excuse for me to be sexist at the table.
Oh.
That's not cool, and I don't like it.
Oh, that's very, very interesting. So what's in the hopper right now, Jason, or what's come out recently that has got you super excited?
Well, this last year has been difficult, I think, for everybody, and I haven't played as much as I usually do. And I'm kind of at wit's end if you ask me what out there is new and hot, because I don't get to play as much as I used to. And a lot of my design is informed by inspiration from other things. I would look to people like Jeon Shim, who's making super interesting games that are designed for solitaire play, that are designed, she calls them keepsake games, games that are creating artifacts of play sort of in their wake, which I think is really smart. So she's inspirational to me, and I have a lot of respect for the work that she's doing. But yeah, it's like I feel a little disconnected right now. And so that's not a great question.
So there's more people playing these games now than has ever been the case. And I would imagine it's by multipliers. And I'm always curious to know from your seat whether you have a sense of why that's the case. Why do you think, you know, in the last 5, 6, 7 years, and especially in the last 2 or 3 years, why do you think that that's the case? Why are more people playing this hobby?
I think there's a number of reasons, some of which I don't understand, obviously, but like D&D is having a cultural moment, right? There's no question about that, that's bringing people into the field. And if weird little games get 1 out of every 1,000 D&D players to take a look at them, then they're doing pretty good. So that's a thing. I also think that communities of practice bring in people like them. So like we see this huge wave of like young queer designers or young marginalized designers that just did not have a seat at the table.
Yeah.
And now they do. And I think that's empowering for those communities. And I think it's healthy for the hobby, healthy for the industry. And just all around, it's a great thing to see, but it's not, I don't think it's because of work that I'm doing, although I do my best to be thoughtful and inclusive about my work. I think that they're doing it for themselves and maximum respect.
Yeah. Yeah. Anything that's concerning to you about that, about the explosion or about the current state of the hobby?
It's interesting. I don't know that I have any concerns. I think it's going to be what it's going to be. I lament some things that seem to be lost. I came up in a pretty rigorous, maybe even cruel culture of playtesting, where the where the expectation was that your game was really ready when you published it, that it had been extensively vetted, and that it was absolutely rock solid. And that's a barrier to entry. That's a gatekeeping function, and I recognize that. But at the same time, I'm also a consumer, and I want to buy games I can play. So that's a thing that I look at, and I have to recalibrate a little bit, because there are people that I respect who are making games that don't really get much playtesting, or games that are iterative, where they're releasing them and saying, yeah, well, this will change over time as I get feedback from people engaging with it. It's not a bad model, but it's a model that just there's some cognitive dissonance for me. And that's I'm sure that's just because I'm old and grumpy.
Yeah. It's funny you say that, because to a certain degree, like I'm trying to be good about that by when my first reaction is like, whoa, no, going, oh, wait, are you just being an old guy and this is not for you? Or, you know, yeah, is there a real concern here?
No, yeah. Question your assumptions, because there's like lyric games are, you know, a whole thing that's developed and is constantly developing. And in some cases, they're not really meant to be played. You know, they're a work of art that stands on its own, and you respect that or you don't, but it's not ascribing the same values that I still like to put in my work. So like, that's cool. It's just a different way of looking at things, and we need to adapt.
Yeah, I agree. I'm trying my hardest. I do better than others, but not as good as I hope to do. So, wow, Jason, this was fantastic, man. I really appreciate you taking the time.
Oh, you asked such good questions, Craig. This was great. I really, I enjoyed it very much.
Well, that's very kind of you. So, Jason, if people want more Mr. Morningstar, where do they go?
Well, my company is Bully Pulpit Games. So come visit me at bullypulpitgames.com. And that's probably the best place to find out about what we're up to. We have a Patreon. So track me down on Patreon. I'm releasing a new game, a playtested new game, every month. These are
that's really funny.
These are, you know, small games, and in some cases they're design experiments, but they're really fun and cool. So
beautiful.
Check me out on Patreon too.
We'll link to both of those on the show notes. So everybody listening right now, you can scroll right down. You can get links to both of those things. Check it out. And for crying out loud, if you have not played Fiasco, you need to fix that, because there's a lot of people you know that don't think they would play games that will sit down and enjoy a game of Fiasco with you. And I am going to share my curated list from Jason when I get it for Camping
for
Gamers.
Are.
You got me super excited for that. But most importantly, you sat through this whole interview and listened to the whole thing. So I want you to know I appreciate you too. Take care.
This episode. Subscribe to Tabletop Talk and share it with your friends. Check out our content on YouTube and Twitch. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook and stay updated on everything coming from Third Floor. All the links are in the show notes. Take care, floorheads.
That was perfect, Jason. Thank you.
Oh, good. Okay.
Perfect. Perfect.
I get fired up. So let me know if I'm talking, if I'm saying too much about things that are not relevant or whatever.
So that's my job, Jason, is to make sure that you sound interesting. All right. Good. So if at any point you don't sound interesting, that's my job to bring us back in. So don't edit yourself. And if we take a hard right turn and it's interesting, we're going to go there. Some of my best conversations have been completely, you know, off script, and we just kind of go down something, or somebody says something offhandedly. I'm like, whoa, wait a minute. So no, please don't edit yourself. Just let me, I'll worry about that. Don't you? Okay.
Yep. Sounds good.
Awesome. See, perfect example of what I'm talking about, Jason.
Oh, that's like, right. We really do enough on a rabbit trail there,
which is awesome. And you know what made me think of it is Lynn Hardy. I had her on the show. She writes for Chaosium, and she talked about several times brought up your LARP designs as part of what influenced her.
What? Really?
Yeah. And I was just like, you know, I was like, I don't think I knew that Jason did that, but you know, it's because I'm an idiot and it just didn't have the awareness, you know? And so that's why I was tentative when I asked you. It's like,
I'm super glad you did. And there is a community divide too. Like in many cases, the people that I'm nerding out about LARP with are different from the people nerding out about Tabletop. Sure. By the way, I'm sincere about that offer. I will help you find a cool game.
Oh, I'm going to take you up on it. That was a huge mistake, because I have it on tape now. I'm definitely going to do that, though, Jason. That's fascinating. All right, I'll bring us back. Jason, you've helped me so much in understanding a lot of these conversations I've had. Your examples are fantastic.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah, thank you. How are you on time? We're at right about an hour. You okay?
Yeah, I'm good. I'm good. I'm kind of losing my voice a little bit, so I may be pausing.
Yeah, take a drink or something. Hey, the beauty of editing, you'll be just succinct the whole time.
That's great. I can't wait.
All right, I'll bring us back. Hey, are you still here? Wow. Well, the episode is over, but if you're bored, why not go to patreon.com and support the show for as little as $1 a month? Yeah, you can just scroll down and get the link. It's Patreon that makes this and all of our other content possible. Don't you want to join the other floorheads on the Patreon Discord? Anyway, thanks for sticking around. Take care.